Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. It's National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and tonight we're talking about what eating disorders are, how they develop, and how those struggling with them, including their families and friends, can find help and support. We're joined in the studio by Terry Halperin Eaton, who is Senior Clinical Supervisor at Walden Behavioral Care in Massachusetts, and Jamie Loud, who is a peer advocate for those with eating disorders. On the phone, we have Roseanne Rook, who's a clinical addiction specialist at Timberline Knowles. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. So
first, what we wanted to do is we have someone here, Jamie Loud, who's willing to share her story and her struggle and success with dealing with eating disorders. And I'd really like to kind of start with that. Do you mind?
Great. So 16 years ago, when I was 15, I was first diagnosed with major depression and eating disorders. Since then, I've added anxiety disorder, OCD, and a plethora of related and unrelated medical diagnoses. My first hospitalization occurred 10 years ago, in 2005. 2 years into college, my eating disorder was ruling my life. I decreased my intake until I was eating no more than 300 calories per day, and I increased my exercise and dance regimen until I burned at least as many calories each day. I became so emaciated that in the January of my junior year, the administration of the school required me to seek treatment. When I was admitted to the inpatient eating disorders hospital, I weighed 86 pounds. My heart rate was dangerously low, as was my blood pressure. My kidney function wasn't good, and neither were my electrolytes. In fact, I later learned that the doctors thought I was about a week away from a heart attack that probably would have killed me. I wasn't just sick, I was dying. In the weeks and months that followed, I battled my way back to physical health and emotional stability. In September, I returned to school, and the following May, I graduated magna cum laude with a BA in math education. I landed my first real job that summer and thought I was cured. I wasn't. 1 year after graduation, I was in a full relapse. Soon after, I was telling my supervisor that I needed to leave for medical. After 10 weeks, I returned to work. While I was out, I started working with a psychologist and a dietitian in their private practices. Although it is difficult to accept that you need help and to agree to go into a treatment facility, the goal there is just to get you stable enough so that you can do the real work of recovery with your outpatient team. That is where change really happens. However, with change comes a lot of different feelings, and many of us don't have the skills to cope with such intense emotions. I was one of those people, and just a few months into therapy, I tried to kill myself for the first time. I was hospitalized again, this time on a general psychiatric unit. Shortly after my return, I was laid off from my job. On my last day, thinking my life was over, I was once again admitted to a psych hospital for having a suicide plan. I participated in a mood disorder program, and I was immediately admitted to the eating disorder hospital. At this point in my life, it was a constant string of treatment programs and hospitalizations. Sometime in there, I returned to work part-time, but that job was punctuated by appointments and medical leaves. I eventually was let go from that job, but I ended up needing long-term hospitalization after a drawn-out suicide attempt. I even was put in a state-run hospital for a period of time. In numbers, over 6 years, I was hospitalized 3 times for eating disorders and 9 times for depression and suicidal ideation. I've been in eating disorder residential treatment 6 times, and I've been in partial or intensive outpatient programs a total of 18 times. There is good news in all of this. In 2011, after much fighting, I was deemed a good candidate for electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT. This was life-changing. ECT changed my brain chemistry enough to let the antidepressants do their jobs, which took the edge off to finally let me do the work I'd been trying to do. It still wasn't easy, but it was possible. At this point, I had, and still have, what I call my dream team of treatment providers, including 2 therapists, a dietitian, a psychopharm, a medical doctor, and other background players. They are the ones who have helped me get onto the path of recovery, and with them by my side, I've made great progress and I've found successes. I still don't work. I haven't since 2010. I'm on Social Security disability. I'm what's called a peer specialist, and that is someone who uses their own lived experiences to help others. So basically, I use my recovery journey to help others move into and through their own recovery. I run peer support groups at a clubhouse, as well as help others one-on-one. I enjoy telling my recovery stories in ways like this and use it to advocate for others who haven't yet found their voice. It's been an incredibly hard road, and I still have many struggles to this day, but I'm proud of how far I've come and where I am.
Wow, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie.
I mean, and I think you touched on so many different pieces.
I'm wondering, Jamie, as a peer advocate and as someone who shares your story, what do you tell young people that are struggling with eating disorders? How do you approach that?
First, you have to tell them that recovery is possible. Mm-hmm. 'Cause without the idea that recovery is real, what's the point? So that's always the first part. The second part is to get help, because you can't do it on your own. And, you know, whether that means a treatment team, whether that means a program, a hospital, having peers around you, people who have gone through it to help you through each part. It's tough work, but it's definitely possible.
Well, I think it was really important that you talked about the numbers of times, because a lot of people think that I didn't get it and, you know, my second attempt, there's no hope, but there's always hope.
There's always hope, yeah. And sometimes you don't know what's going to be the one that's going to change your life.
But
how aware were you of having eating disorders early on when you started having some of the symptoms? Did you know what was going on?
In the back of your head, you always do, but in some ways the denial is so strong. When my school required me to get treatment, I could not believe that I needed help, and I said, absolutely not. You know, I mean, despite limiting the calories and exercising and purging and diet pills, I still thought I'm fine. I didn't need help. And when I got into my evaluation to be for treatment, and they said, oh, you belong in the hospital, and I left, and I said, no, I don't. And it took me 10 days to come back around to the idea.
I'm wondering, because it's just unfathomable what you've been through, and kind of an incredible story of these treatments and this wonderful coming together. But I'm wondering how, I guess for me, how it manifested in your mind, what you saw, what you experienced, what it was like for you that kind of, the symptoms that you were experiencing and all that, like what can you give us a look inside of the mind of somebody who's suffering from this?
The biggest thing is trying to find control, and whether or not I actually knew that at the time, I'm not sure, but that's what I was looking for. I had a pretty unstable childhood life. I was in college and it was a new experience, and my food intake and my weight was something I could control. But some of the symptoms were, you know, really obsessive about my body and what they call body checking, which can take many different forms, staring in the mirror, physically pinching to see if you can find fat or around your wrist to see how big your wrists are. Of course, limiting your intake, trying to control the intake, any type of purging. I kind of say to people, if you're purging, that's not normal. That is an eating disorder symptom. It doesn't matter kind of how many times or how many times a week. That's not okay. That's not healthy. Again, kind of obsessive with diet pills, not really caring what the back of the bottle said, just taking them as I wished. Only drinking caffeinated teas or coffee to kind of keep your metabolism going. Even things like, if I'm in a cold room, I might not put on a sweater because your body is fighting off to get warm and you're burning off more calories. I mean, at that point in my life, I was afraid of the calories in toothpaste, you know, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't have a cough drop if I were sick because of the calories. And you're just, your mind's in a completely different place.
So Terry, when you hear this story, there's not a lot of time, but can you just kind of tell us, as a clinician who works in this field, what does this make you think of?
Well, these rituals sit in the body. We all have a relationship to food, and we create rituals, whether healthy or unhealthy, related to our food intake. And when these rituals become unhealthy, we cut off our experience of living in the body. We cut off that sense of that food is fuel. And so the control pieces, the ritual pieces, prevent us from living fully in the body, mind, in a healthy and productive way.
And this isn't limited to young ladies. It's, young men have it as well.
No, there's a large male population, and increasingly so with some of the transgendered community and people making transitions to want to look different than their normal body
and
type.
And it's not limited to young people. It's all ages.
Oh, that's okay.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So we also have on the phone, we're going to come back and talk to Roseanne Rook from Timberline Knowles, and we're talking about eating disorders during National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We'll be back right after this break. We're joined by Terry Halperin Eaton, Jamie Loud, and on the phone, Roseanne Rook from Timberline Knowles.
So, Roseanne, I want to pull you into the conversation now. And we just heard this poignant story from Jamie. I was wondering if you would kind of tell our listening audience what is an eating disorder? What are the eating disorders and kind of a little where they come from? And hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Eating disorders, too, I think that there's been such a misconception because everybody thinks of it as somebody extremely underweight and therefore, I think, goes unnoticed. Also, unless somebody has anorexia, even when they come into treatment, it's unfortunate because they're like, I know I don't look like I have an eating disorder. So first of all, yes, very familiar is anorexia, which is the restricting of food, low body weight, the bulimia, which is the binging, large amount of food, and purging. Purging can be many different ways. It was mentioned. It could be an exercise and laxatives. It's not just in the fact of purging. And then the idea of it as being an addiction, I think, is something that's been very difficult for people to understand. Hopefully not as much now. But the important thing is to understand that eating disorders serve the same purpose as someone with a substance abuse problem.
And what's that purpose?
The purpose is basically to cope with the uncopeable. It's underlying issues that it serves a purpose to either, it's kind of a feel-good fast is the way I say it. Everybody has underlying issues and problems and the need to feel full. When you have an addiction, one of the behaviors that you tend to act out in, whichever one you choose, tends to fill that need. I kind of want to say it's, if you think about it, when for some people something can make them feel good fast, that's fine, it's great. However, it starts to cause problems, they don't continue to do it. When you have an addiction or this eating disorder, like a lot of people aren't going to feel good from being hungry, which shows when there's an actual increase in dopamine because somebody's stomach is growling, shows a sign of, wow, this feels really good, and they're going to continue to do that.
And what kind of does research show are, like, the causes?
The underlying, and it was mentioned as far as control, is the main, it's not always what somebody thinks, and it may not always be the start. I do think that although it isn't really a body image thing, it almost always starts that way. And the fact of wanting to look good, that's what media says. However, the more in treatment and more we talk, there's a lot of trauma behind it. It doesn't always have to be trauma. But when it's talking about sexual trauma, there's times the women want to lose weight so they can disappear. They just want to get small enough to disappear. There's women that will eat to be so far overweight, feeling that they won't, that the opposite sex will not be attracted to them. So there's a lot of different, in some people it's punishment, just like self-harm. Mm-hmm. I don't deserve to eat. People say, no, I don't deserve that. So they, if they've been mistreated and feel like they're not worth anything, sometimes that becomes their own way of punishment.
Terry, when you know, first encounter a client that it comes to you with a diagnosis of an eating disorder. What route of treatment do you take?
Well, I want to be sensitive to that. It is a disease of denial, and that it's a secret disorder that isn't easy to talk about. And coming off of what Roseanne's talking about related to lack of worth and the wish to be invisible, not to be seen, no matter what your diagnosis is, to not have that inner experience be seen, I want to be sensitive with a client as to what parts of self can be seen. Nobody wants, when people are in denial about their eating disorder or because it's a secret disorder, they don't want to be talking about their relationship to food. So really it's building strengths, looking at what kind of coping skills they do have that are potentially skills we can build on in order to get to break through some of the denial and get to helping strategies that can help coping skills.
Roseanne, the clients that you see at Timberline Knowles, they are they of a particular age? Terry and Jamie both said that, you know, it's across genders. Transgendered people show up with it. So do you see ever any trends that you might be reflected in popular culture, or is it kind of a straight across the board consistent population that you deal with?
I'm going to say, you know, I can't say as far as maybe culture-wise. We have some Orientals. We obviously have African-American. And everybody that has come in, there's not been obviously free from developing an eating disorder. As far as age, our youngest is 13. We've had women up to about 70 years old in our treatment. And the eating disorders have run, I mean, say when women came up to in their 50s. So that's a wide range.
Right, and I just want to be clear, Timberline Knowles is for women.
Yeah, it's a woman.
Yes, female only, yes, yeah. Yes. And what I also have noticed is that dealing with a woman that has had an eating disorder 30, 35 years significantly has been totally hijacked by it. I mean, everybody is, and it's just a hard thing to get out of, but when somebody has been in it, different from a teen that we've had it in 4 or 5 years to a woman that's been doing it for 35 years, extremely difficult to work with.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we've seen that where we are. I just had a question for Terry and Jamie. We were talking about, you know, popular culture and photoshopping and all that, and actually Roseanne had mentioned that it may start as a self-image issue. Can you kind of talk about that?
I think the media promotes distortion in body image mm-hmm. and sexuality that might be uncomfortable for some living in a body where the culture says, show yourself, when actually it doesn't feel right to show yourself, to show skin, to show. So I think some of the media's focus and music's focus promotes a lack of comfort about living in the body. And I see trends among college students. Certainly it's more seasonal as college students have time on their hands, vacations or summer breaks. They tend to come into treatment because it's starting to manifest in relationship to the people they're living with, seeing that, wow, I don't eat like them. I have rituals that make me eat behind closed doors or don't let me be social in the context of dining halls or going out to eat together.
One thing I've really heard from everybody right now is how secret it is. And it's, you know, it's like same with all the addictions is the addictions. People aren't sitting around going, let's party together and let's do this together. It's all these people hiding in their rooms doing these things that are hurting themselves.
Yeah, and the shame behind it and just the pressure. I'm interested when we come back of just learning, you know, you're hearing all the clinicians talk, Jamie, and I just want to kind of get a little feedback and learn a little more about you know, what, how it's reflected in you and now the people that you're working with. Jamie, I wanted to ask you, now that you know you are a peer advocate and you have quite a story to share with other people suffering from this, but what are you hearing? What's the common thread that you hear from people that are suffering from this?
I'm not really sure, except to say that, you know, getting into treatment is terribly difficult because you're dealing with the physical symptoms. And we were just talking about that with addiction, you abstain from your substance of choice. With eating disorders, you have to learn how to eat. And you can't abstain from food. You actually have to face your fears with food. And it's three meals a day, three snacks a day, every day. And it's constant. And there's a lot of physical feelings that go with refeeding syndrome when you're starting to eat again after a long period of time of not eating or constantly using other ways to purge. And then dealing with the feelings that come up, because really what we've been doing is ignoring our feelings and trying to control our feelings. And you start to eat and all these feelings come up. And so you're dealing with physical and emotional feelings at the same time. And that is terribly difficult and takes a lot of coping skills. And sometimes we think we don't have any coping skills.
I just a quick question for Roseanne. You know, when Jamie was talking about that, it occurs to me that in the substance abuse field, we do concurrent treatment, treating the underlying disorders while we're treating the substance abuse. That's what works, and that's what research shows that works. I'm wondering, in treating eating disorders, is it important to address the underlying issues concurrent while you're dealing with the eating disorders?
Oh, absolutely. And just like Jamie had mentioned, how there was the depression, and even the depression was just as hard to get under control. You go through a series of the antidepressants and seeing what works. The only thing that we may back off from is some trauma work. In any area when some severe trauma is being worked on, often the actual behaviors increase. And if somebody starts to fully engage in a behavior, that part of the behavior or therapy will be backed off from. But it's always going to be looking at underlying issues. As far as, to me, the bottom line, and I've said this, we can all be in a group, and I always say, if we're not drinking or drugging or self-harming, eating or throwing up, everybody's sitting in the same pain. So often when we're in something, the treatment is the pain and major shame with eating disorders. Also looking at right, it's when we talk about relapse, and what is recovery? What is abstinence? It's very different for eating disorders. So it is easier to say, with substances, you just can't touch it. When we're dealing with the eating disorders, where we're saying don't overeat or you have to eat. Also, how absolutely, as Jamie said, uncomfortable it is during the refeeding, during weight gain, because they're carrying that around every minute, 24 hours a day, and how they feel. It's actually keeping them, I think it's very hard for some of them to actually keep their mind on our group and what we're talking about, because it's going to, oh, I have another meal, I have to have a snack, how many calories are in this, and the body checking, and that can be something that is on their mind all day, where, you know, people have cravings for substances. However, with the eating disorders, that is in front of them, like she said, six times a day.
Wow.
Absolutely important to deal with any mood disorder.
Yeah, I've been watching everybody nod as you talk here. I mean, in agreement. So we just started talking about, so first of all, how, if I were a 23-year-old woman, I'm dealing with an eating disorder. I know I am, because it's something I've been looking at. How would I start getting help?
If you're local in the Boston area, I suggest META, which is the Multi-Service Eating Disorder Association.
Massachusetts Eating...
Multi-Service Eating Disorder Service.
M-E-D-A.
Yeah. And so they're in Newton, and they provide a lot of services, and you can go in and kind of get evaluated. They can help you set up with the treatment team. If they think that you need more treatment, you can help. They can help you refer to places. They have a ton of support groups. They do education and outreach. This week they have events for National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. They're a great organization. If you don't know that you need treatment or you don't know that you need a program.
Yeah, we try to send as many people as we can there.
One of the great things that they have there is a hope and inspiration group where you can show up, be anonymous, listen to a recovery speaker, hear a story that might be, that might resonate, that might be part of your own story, and wonder, be curious, ask questions about what kind of services can support someone with an eating disorder. Because again, it's a secret disorder. There's a lot of shame, and it could be hard to show up for an intake, but less hard to show up in a group of people where you're hearing someone's recovery story. And the recovery of hope is a significant part of treatment and also could be a first step.
Sure.
And Hope and Inspiration is free once a month, so it's a great resource.
That sounds wonderful.
What's the website for that?
META is meda-inc.org.
Great. I'm wondering, Jamie, what your family's response was when you were first going through, you know, showing the signs of the eating disorders and getting treated.
It was hard. I think that my dad raised me, and there was a lot of denial on his part to think that how sick I really was. You know, even I was diagnosed as a teenager in high school, but kind of had it under wraps enough for a while, and then I was away at college, and it really got worse. And I remember going into the administration's office, and they looked at him and they said, well, what do you think is going on? And he's like, she's just dancing a lot, you know? And it's just so hard to wrap your head around that your daughter is dying or your son or your daughter is dying at this point. I also know a lot of people in my family and the people that were closest with me were talking behind my back and didn't know what to do. I had a professor who I was extremely close with say, you were very difficult to deal with at that time, but we didn't know what to do. Mm. And so everyone kind of could see it. I mean, with anorexia, you kind of show it. In my case, I showed it. If you're struggling with bulimia or other eating disorders, you might not see it as obvious. But nobody really knew what to do and how to approach it. And so they all kind of ignored it for a while until finally, in my case, the school stepped in.
So Roseanne, when you hear the sentence, all the family were talking about it behind their back, but they didn't know what to do. What should a family do?
That's just that a family needs to get help themselves. I think that I find with eating disorders, there's probably more enabling that goes on than with substance abuse, where they kind of get fed up with it and push them away. There's that physical element that somebody wants to fix. However, I've also seen that there is also the shame in it and wanting to think, well, it'll just pass. I know it'll pass. And trying to fix it themselves, whether trying to say eat, that's another one, if you would just eat. So I think the idea is to go to the person with eating disorder directly just isn't going to work. You know, when they're in that state and they're in such a state of denial and defense, that to address them is not going to work on your own. To get some help from a program, from a therapist, even if it was to do an intervention, again, it's not in we need you to eat. It's the idea is we want you to be well. And I also feel that when families see some of this, instead of addressing them on their behavior, maybe look into what's going on, the way they feel. What's going on? What's different? Can we talk? Because it's not just the physical signs. A lot of that comes way before is the depression or the low self-esteem, the isolation. A lot of those things are things that parents could start to see in their children.
Right. Terry, I'm interested in understanding what kind of treatment works.
I can talk about that. I just want to say, based on what Roseanne just said, that the cultural pieces, how we eat and how we are brought up to eat in relationship to each other and in relationship to some of the genetic pieces, the dinner time rituals, these are really important pieces that shape our identity and relationship to food.
When we come back after the break, we want to hear more about treatment and how people can find help, but what kind of treatment works. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We're talking about eating disorders. We'll be back right after the break. Before we went to the break, Terry, I asked you a question about what works in treating this kind of, this is a big spectrum of stuff, it sounds like. What works in treatment?
Well, what Jamie referred to about her dream team is a group of specialists who understand that it's about building trust, and it's about the nutritional aspect, the psychopharmacology, the psychotherapeutic, the medical issues, and that as one is ready for change, that it's a process of helping that development of acceptance about what is, the reality of what is. So some people can be close to a heart attack or medical issues that they'll still be in denial about. And that's going to take the client trusting that the clinician or the doctor is telling them the truth. So this trust piece is a huge piece. What works in terms of my own psychotherapeutic intervention is I believe that the disorder sits in the body. That doesn't mean it doesn't sit in the mind, because the body and the mind are connected, but that it's identity work that has to begin with an acknowledgement that feelings sit in the body, and to work with where the feelings live in the body and how those feelings can begin to shift and be explored is the way, the pathway towards healing.
We have a call coming in right now. Jenna, you're on Right Turn Radio. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I am a dietitian from Woburn, Massachusetts, and I am specialize in eating disorders as well. I used to work at Walden Behavioral Care, and I just wanted to build on what Terry was saying about eating disorders in regards to the context of eating. So it's not so much what you're eating all the time, but the context of, you know, are you in a safe environment? Are you around people that you trust? Are there certain patterns of eating, such as, you know, black and white thinking, eating the same foods every day? And so I think that's an important part of treatment, is to challenge those patterns and, you know, have people break the rigidity that comes with eating disorders.
Well, one of the other things that was mentioned is that a team approach. So it sounds like there needs to be someone to help you. You know, there needs to be medication. There needs to be a physician to deal with the physical stuff, a psychiatrist.
Absolutely.
Nutritionist.
A nutritionist and therapists who can really kind of make a team.
And I'm an expressive therapist, so I'm working with putting the body into action. Action-oriented psychotherapy, where you're not sitting and talking about your feelings necessarily. You might be using art or poetry or music to express or help you to express some of the more difficult things that one couldn't talk about in words.
So, Roseanne, do you want to talk a little bit, because we're running out of time, about kind of a bit of a treatment approach?
Yes. Mention the dream team. That's absolutely what we do at Kimberly Knowles, is the idea of having the psychiatrist, the family therapist, which is also very important, and able to deal with the family, the primary therapist, and they have access to an eating disorder specialist, dietitian, nutritionist. They do. We also have the dance movement and the yoga therapy for getting in touch with the body, process groups, and the 12 steps really are important. Since an eating disorder is no different than any other addiction, the 12 steps are the best way to deal with it, also, but in conjunction, definitely, with having therapy.
Well, thank you. Thanks a lot for that input.
Roseanne, how would people access your services? Do you have a website at Timberline Knowles?
It is timberlineknowles.com, and it'll show you all the services that we offer. You can reach, actually, administration for any questions. Actually, all of our intake people are all clinicians.
Great.
So they could, which is really helpful, even if you just need to ask questions. It was mentioned the fear or fearing getting into treatment. I think just to talk to somebody, and again, it's that idea is, yeah, I know what you're talking about, to find comfort in it, maybe not such a fear of where you may be coming.
I think that
any questions.
That first initial step is so important. And I want to thank all of you, Terry and Roseanne and Jamie, for talking with us about this. We're just opening this conversation up, and we're going to have to do more shows about this. But Jamie, we wanted to give you the last word. And what would you say to maybe some listeners out there who have a family member suffering from this, or who are going through it themselves? What advice from a peer do you have to offer?
Get help. You can't do this on your own. Whether it's a therapist, whether it's a trusted individual in your family, whether it's calling an organization, whether it's getting treatment, tell somebody, because it is secretive and we think that we know what we're doing, and just get help and reach out, and to know that recovery is possible and recovery is real, and it's a journey. And it's not one step. And as you heard from my story, that it took multiple hospitalizations and multiple programs and several years and different trials and tribulations and many ups and downs. And it continues today. My struggles aren't over. But that it's hundreds of little steps that creates a life worth living. And that's really what it's all about.
Jamie Loud, thank you for your bravery and sharing your story with us. It was very... very powerful for me. And Terry Halperin Eaton, thank you so much for coming in, Terry. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Roseanne Rook, thank you so much for calling in today. We'd love to have all you guys back.
They warned us it was too big a topic to do in an hour.
And we went ahead and did it anyway.
They'd be right.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.